General Store Publishing House presents stories from Run of the Town by Terence Rundle West. Published in 2006, these 17 short stories chronicle life in small-town Northern Ontario in the years between 1940 and 1965. Read by Virginia West. Burwash Arnie.
"Wonder what's going on behind the Half Moon Cafe?" Mom asked from the back window of our apartment overlooking the alley. We lived over the store on the main corner of town, and not too much past our notice. I abandoned the Star Weekly funnies and ran to the window.
"Where?"
Mom pointed to the crowd forming around the garbage platform behind the restaurant three buildings over.
"Geez, Mom, could be an animal. Remember the moose that crashed through the window at Luxury Cafe last year?"
"Moose dines in luxury," Dad intoned from his prone position on the couch. I groaned. The line had been funny when the local paper first printed it a year earlier. But Dad wouldn't let it go, and now all my relatives from Hearst to Toronto had heard it twice.
"Doubt that," Mom said. "People are standing too close for it to be a wild animal."
My thoughts went to Trudy, the bag lady, but I'd never bring that up in front of the folks. She'd been getting frisky with some of the tramps who slept in the woods between the tracks and the sawmill, the place we called the jungle. My sister said she was certifiable, but that didn't seem to bother the hobos who'd stuck to her like flies on horse balls the day Rusty and I caught her taking them into Tarafenko's woodshed. We tried to peek through a crack in the wall, but couldn't see anything and gave up.
"Bet it's a fight," I said, grabbing my windbreaker and heading for the stairs. "There's lots of lumberjacks in town waiting for freeze-up." My heart raced. Two lumberjacks going at it was something to see. They used anything, fists, teeth, hobnail boots. And they pulled hair, too, especially in the spring when they came out of the bush with it hanging down over their shoulders.
"Be careful," Mom yelled. "Stand well back, whatever it is." "Yeah, yeah," I shouted, opening the door, my 12-year-old pulse racing.
Two at a time, I was down the stairs, out onto the sidewalk and closing in on the alley. On the street, people were streaming towards the rear of the restaurant, speeding up as they got closer like leaves around a sewer grate that has just been unplugged. As I moved, I fumbled with the zipper on my jacket, taking no note of who was in the crowd, even ignoring the brand-new bullet-nosed 1952 Studebaker parked in front of our store.
"R.J. Martin," a voice said. "Where do you think you're off to?"
I searched for the voice and found a family friend shaking his head in my direction. He stood apart from the crowd with his hands in his back pockets, a sad expression on his face.
"What's going on, Yallo?" I asked. "You don't want to know."
"Why?" I asked, frowning but not stopping. If he answered, I didn't hear because I was already pushing my way through the adults toward the excitement. As I progressed, I began eliminating the possibilities. Already I could tell it wasn't a fight. I'd seen enough fights outside the Queen's Hotel to recognize the look of primitive fascination that overtakes spectators, and I wasn't seeing that today. It wasn't danger, either, like you'd expect if some semi-starved bear had come in from the bush for an easy meal at a garbage can. I knew what fear looked like, and I wasn't reading that at all. Fear was what had been on the faces of fleeing shoppers the day the runaway horses, steam gushing from inflamed nostrils, dragged a sleigh down George Street from the Capitol Hotel to Freeman Smith's confectionery. Mothers had grabbed children, and terrified shoppers scrambled for the protection of doorways. It had taken the unmistakable smack of horseflesh on metal, as the sleigh tangled with a parked truck and the horses went down, to bring people back onto the street. I was baffled. If it wasn't a fight, and it wasn't a wild animal, then what was I heading for? I began to slow my pace to scrutinize more carefully the adult faces above me for signs, conscious of the absence of hooting and whistling that usually accompanied spectator events. People stood silent, almost mesmerized. For a second I thought I read disgust, but I sensed more, though I couldn't put a finger on it. By now my short legs had carried me to the epicenter and I ceased speculating. To my relief, several chums had beaten me to the ringside position and were already in a festive mood. I joined in. Before us, on the garbage platform, an old geezer stood gnawing a half-consumed steak. People around me were calling him Burwash Arnie.
"Burwash," I said to Nelson, who was standing beside me. "What kind of name is that?"
Usually I hardly dared talk to Nelson. He was 3 years my senior and didn't have much time for me. Today, with the excitement, it didn't seem to matter.
"It's a jail, dum-dum," Nelson said. "Arnie spends so much time there, they've named him after it."
"He's a criminal?"
"Nah, just a drunk."
"Hey, Burwash!" a school chum shouted. "Don't forget your veggies! Gotta be some peas and carrots down there somewhere!"
Nelson laughed. So did I. A few of the adults did, too. But it wasn't the side-splitting laughter we usually shared while watching the Bowery Boys at the Cartier Theater.
"Hold it, Arnie!" another kid yelled. "Don't eat another bite! I'll run home and get you some ketchup for that steak bone!"
The preteen guys were getting into it now. The jibes flew. "Time to get yourself back to jail, Arnie. Winter's coming."
And, "Wouldn't a nice bottle of goof wash that steak down just proper?"
But Arnie didn't seem to notice. He was on his knees, one shoulder leaning against the garbage barrel for balance as he pressed the steak to his lips with trembling hands. He looked like a man who hadn't seen food in a long time. I got the feeling that if you kicked the barrel away, he would tumble over. But I didn't say this for fear someone might think it was a good idea.
"Where does he live, Nelson?" I asked.
Nelson shrugged. "Probably the jungle." The jungle. I hadn't been near there since my scare a year and a half earlier, but there was something familiar about Arnie. I began to study the face. His hair, caked in dirt, fell around his pulpy red nose and spiderweb cheeks. There was a milkiness about his eyes that suggested blindness, but he had navigated his way to the garbage cans all right, so I figured he must be able to see. It occurred to me that it'd be almost a blessing if he were blind. Then he wouldn't have to witness all these people leering at him.
"Holy cow, Nels," I said. "Look at his hands."
"Oh, that's nothing," Nelson said. "All them old booze hounds get like that." Unobtrusively, I tugged a small band-aid off my finger and let it fall to the ground. Earlier, I'd had a sliver with a tiny speck of blood. I peeked at my own soft hands, then back at Arnie's. His turgid fingers, cracked and raw and holding the meat to his bearded face, reminded me of boiled wieners. I wondered if they might snap off in the subarctic winter that was soon to come. He wore a red and black checkered shirt that might have kept him warm were it not for the missing buttons that exposed the upper part of his chest in a huge, hairy V. A blue tattoo that reminded me of my brother's regimental badge disappeared under the lumberjack shirt. And it crossed my mind he might be one of those vets Dad said couldn't get over the war because they'd seen too many horrible things. The crotch of his stained woolen trousers hung at his knees, fly wide open. When he'd chewed off all he could from the steak, he let it fall and began the delicate job of pulling his body up into position to attempt another forage into the garbage container. I held my breath. Trembling, one fistful of wieners found its way to the top of the barrel, then the other, and slowly he hauled himself up until he hung over the opening. But removing his hands to reach for food must have unbalanced him, because he rocked on his heels and I was certain he was going to pedal backwards off the platform. He stood swaying, knees flexing, arms poking the air, hips undulating back and forth like a belly dancer. There was a gasp from the crowd, which he must have heard, because when he'd regained control he turned his head in our direction for an instant before lowering his upper body into the barrel. As his torso went down, a cloud of flies came up, buzzing angrily around him.
"What's he going to come up with this time?" Nelson hollered.
I looked up at Nelson and laughed. He smiled down at me. I felt older standing next to him, almost worldly.
"Two bits, it's chop suey," another kid replied. "Yeah, well, I bet it's..."
The back door of the restaurant opened. The banter stopped. Wing Wan, the owner, was ushering Officer Barnsworth out onto the steps.
"Ah, shucks, it's barn smell," Nelson said.
A moan of disappointment escaped the lips of my young friends.
"He's going to ruin everything," I shouted. "Now we'll never know what kind of delight Burwash would have come up with."
Within seconds, Officer Barnsworth climbed the platform, grabbed a confused Arnie by the back of the pants, and pivoted him in our direction. I jumped aside, but as he came abreast, Arnie's vitreous eyes caught mine, and he blinked as if searching his alcohol-fogged mind for where he'd seen me before. Suddenly, his head jerked, and a moan vibrated from deep in his throat. He knew where our paths had crossed, and the instant I heard that hollow, defeated wail, I did too. 50, 100 years could never erase that sound. In an air-sucking implosion, the memory of our one and only encounter detonated in my brain. How could I have mistaken him for some other vagrant? I shook my head violently to cast away the black spots that pirouetted dizzily in front of my eyes. My smart mouth fell shut. I had hurt this man in the jungle a year and a half earlier.
I had smashed the one thing on God's earth still dear to him, his last bottle of goof. I tried to tell myself that Rusty, Normie, and Vaco had been just as guilty, but that was a lie. I alone was responsible for the crime. Surely the people around me could read the guilt in my expression and would be judging me. My face flushed around the plastic smile that clung to my lips. I stood naked, exposed in my 12th year by a drunk from the jungle. But the adults behind me, their eyes fixed on Burwash, didn't seem to notice my loss of swagger. They parted to let him through, and as I turned my sheepish eyes to them, I realized mine wasn't the only troubled conscience in this gathering. Arnie was led away, and in his wake, lips clenched, eyes to the ground like church communicants departing the holy altar, the townsfolk filtered off, carrying with them the same enigmatic expression I'd seen earlier as I'd pushed my way to the front of the crowd. But now, at last, I was beginning to understand what they were feeling, even though it would take half a century to fully comprehend and find the correct words. Yes, there was pity, and yes, a touch of there but for the grace of God, and of course there was a dollop of guilt for not doing more for Arnie and his ilk, even in that age before welfare, when foul-smelling whiskered drunks regularly wore out the welcome mat at back doors. But the overriding sentiment was compassion for a fellow human being. Compassion, preached ad nauseam in Sunday school, absorbed in a back alley behind a greasy café.